Greetings and good evening again to each one of you. When we sing songs, a lot of times we're supposed to be, I think at least, answering some of these questions these songs ask us. But we get caught away sometimes in the melody and carrying the tune and just the joy of singing it. Maybe we miss some of these questions. Am I a soldier of the cross? A follower of the Lamb? And shall I fear to own His cause or blush to speak His name? Must I be carried to the skies on flowery beds of ease while others fought to win the prize and sailed through bloody seas? Am I a soldier of the cross? What an astounding question. But also maybe it's a question that is somewhat hard to understand. A soldier of the cross. You know, the Bible talks about being a soldier in many different places. The Apostle Paul references to being a soldier, being in war. But what does it mean for us to be a soldier of the cross? You know, this week it's titled Bible Boot Camp. If we were to join the military, that would take some commitment, wouldn't it? But, you know, it wouldn't really be all that hard. If we joined the military and we started to train for a battle, that would be pretty difficult, but not overly. People don't fail at joining the military. You know, people don't fail at training for battle. I can imagine it being very hard to build a battleship. But maybe it isn't that hard. Make sure it floats. Make sure it has enough guns. It's when that battleship is in the middle of the war is when it's going to get hard. It's not that hard to come to these meetings. Maybe it's not that hard to fill out that sheet of paper and send it in the mail. We understand it's not easy making commitments. It's not easy fasting and praying. Yes, these things can be difficult. Striving, but it's not where men fall. Men go down in the war. And when I think of war and I think of battle, I think of possibly one of the most bloodiest battles ever fought in the history of the world. It would have been in World War II. Most of you probably remember or know, remember studying this, the Battle of Okinawa. What an amazing story. What an amazing account. You know, this was not too long after D-Day, or if you remember in your history lessons, when the United States stormed Normandy. Now, that might have been the bloodiest hour of history, but that was nothing compared to Okinawa. But I have to wonder, as these soldiers who were well trained, we know that for certain, these soldiers who had made a commitment long ago, these soldiers who had sacrificed probably everything, they sacrificed their friends, their comfortable life, their family, and they went into train to fight in the war. You know, in the middle of the night, when all these ships are coming up to the shores of Okinawa, it's an island that separates them from Japan. And everybody in the world knows that this is the pivotal point of the war. The Japanese have been terrorizing people. The Japanese had struck so much fear in people's lives because of their radical tactics. Their attack on Pearl Harbor. These were vicious, vicious men. You know, but the Americans knew and the Allies knew that if they could capture Okinawa and they could make that their base, there was nothing going to stop them from the motherland. There was nothing going to stop them from reaching Japan. And not only did they know it, but every Japanese soldier knew it as well. Every Japanese civilian knew it. And as these ships, and as everybody prepared to take this island, the pressure was on. And you know, we can't really even fathom it. I imagine a lot of people praying. I imagine a lot of people had pictures of their loved ones and they were kissing pictures and passing letters to their friends saying, if I don't make it, take this to my family. I imagine it was a very sober time. I also can imagine that nobody there was thinking that maybe they had trained too much for this. Nobody there was thinking, I didn't have to give all that I did for this. Along with this, you have cooks and medics, nurses, doctors, all these people that are kind of behind the scenes. But they also know that if things get bad, they're going to be involved very quickly. Now what if I was able to gather that entire army? All the American troops, all the Allies, and what if I was to prophesy of what was going to come? So I gather everybody around, hundreds of thousands, and I say, after this battle is over, America is going to win. America is going to be victorious over this island. You can probably hear the shouts and the cheers. The victory has finally come. A five-year-old war is over. But then I say, however, this island is going to hold the bodies of 250,000 people. The atmosphere would have changed. Now what if I were to prophesy to you all? Jesus Christ has won the battle, hasn't He? And we can be victorious in that, and we can rejoice in that. But most are going to perish. Most are going to die. I was talking to a young father not too long ago, and he just walked up to my vehicle and he said, you know, I went to boot camp since I was young. I'm sorry, I went to Bible school since I was young. We tried to go to all these Bible schools in Pennsylvania, and I had this, you know, you kind of get this core group of people that you get to know real well from different states. And he says, there's none of them left. None of them left. They've all gone different ways. You reach out to friends and they're no longer in our churches. They're no longer living for Jesus like we would think to be that we need to do. They've chosen some path. They've perished along the way. Does that change the atmosphere here? It's sobering, isn't it? You get a group of young people here. You get 100 young people here that are set on serving God, but to know that many will probably perish. Now I say that not reflecting on your character or your sincerity or your ability to love God right now, but just on statistics. Most don't make it. Most fall by the way. Most get distracted. Most are pulled away from the war. Most think it's too hard. It's too much of a sacrifice. I can't do it. There's got to be an easier way. They get tired of the blood and the sweat and the tears. why does there have to be so much structure? Why is it so rigid and strict? Why can't I have a little room? And the answer to that is that there's brothers and sisters around you that can see Okinawa. They can see the war that's raging out there. They see the sincerity of this. They see the number of casualties. They see the dead bodies. And they realize there is no room for casualness. There is no room for error. There is no room for being sloppy. You will die. There is no room for your own will to live. There is no room for your own agenda. There is no room for you to do it your way. It's sudden death. They look out ahead and they see Normandy. They see casualties. And they plead with you. Oh, keep your heart set. We all probably enjoy reading about David's mighty men, don't we? That's encouraging. It's encouraging to know there's this little group of people fleeing through the mountainside, fleeing for their lives, but there's these mighty men that I would put up against anyone. These mighty men that can kill 800 in one day. These men that were born for the war. These men that when they're walking about their business, they're thinking of the war. They're thinking of the battle. In 2 Samuel 23:11, this states, "And after him, which is Eleazar, the last mighty man they mentioned, was Shammah, the son of Agee, the Hararite. And the Philistines were gathered together into a troop where was a piece of ground full of lentils." You got to love this verse, don't we? "And the people fled from the Philistines." It's just common. "But he stood in the midst of the ground and defended it and slew the Philistines, and the Lord wrought a great victory." And when I look at this verse, you know, you have this picture of this man standing in this field, and all of a sudden he's alone. Everybody's left. Everybody's run. I will not give up. And because of the Lord, this man, Agee, he defends the entire army. And the Lord Jesus Christ has wrought a victory. But I have to think when I see this verse, what kind of father do you think Agee was here? Shema was the warrior. But it says here, the son of Agee. What kind of father was he, you think? You think he was probably just pretty casual? I mean, he's got this son out there that single-handedly defeats the Philistines. What kind of father was he? Was he a father that just kind of let things slide maybe when he was young? Maybe it's a father that just thought there would always be peace in the land. There's no point in training up soldiers. There isn't going to be a war. I guarantee it wasn't that. He was a father that saw out there all the fighting, all the wars, the enemy that's always trying to come into their camps, the Philistines, all these different people. You know, I have to think of my own family. I think of my children. I think of my oldest, Logan, and Adeline, and Abigail, and my little ones. And you know, I'm not training you children so you can be good husbands and good wives and have nice little homes and nice little yards and keep everything nice and tidy and have a nice, beautiful business. It's not what we're doing here. We're training you for a war. We're training you for a battle. Because we know for certain you're going to face it. We know for certain that if you're not ready and prepared, that you'll lose that battle. That's why there's got to be structure. That's why there's got to be these kind of things. Because, you know, without it, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And I wouldn't trust it. I wouldn't trust it. Do we really envision it? Do we envision it like this? That the battle is raging. Do we see it like this? Jonathan, what a man. What a soldier. You know, if you look around and you see the people that are just kind of, that's too hard. Relax. You know what marvels me? If these people had fruit in their lives, they might be able to stand on it some. But you never see that. You never see that. Those who look down on us for being too serious, for being too radical, their lives are shambles. Their churches are falling apart. The world is swallowing up whole. Rejoice not against me, O mine enemy. When I fall, I shall arise. When I sit in darkness, the Lord shall be a light unto me. You know, it's kind of interesting that dark day there. When them soldiers, they knew it was going to be a bloodbath when they got off them ships. But to their amazement, there was no pressure there off the beach. It was the exact opposite of D-Day. And the entire army stormed this island without any resistance. They looked around and thought, maybe they fled. What happened to the enemy? Did the enemy give up? Is this going to be an easier thing than we thought? Did we just win the victory? 130,000 Japanese lay hidden in holes all through that island. It was horrendous. It was terrible. The screaming. You know, they fought through that island. And when they came near the end of that island, surely this thing's about over. They came to a location called Hacksaw Ridge. Maybe you're familiar with it. 400-foot sheer cliff. And it was the last stand for the Japanese. And they knew that in order to get over this cliff, these people would have to devise some type of plan. But they also knew that as they came over this, however they got there, however they climbed this 400 feet, they were going to be sitting ducks. But you know, this battle, this army, these men, they were here to win. They were here to take this island at all costs. And they devised a big system of webs to climb this 400 feet. And they stormed it in different waves after waves after waves. And you know, the problem became that you have all these people getting killed, all these people getting shot. They get over there in waves and the Japanese couldn't kill them all. What do we do with these wounded men? There was a soldier there. There was a conscientious objector that didn't want to fight. He wasn't going to fight. He wasn't going to lift his arm against anyone. And so he got up on top of that embankment and he started seeing what was befalling in front of him, all these bodies, all these people moaning and screaming. And he grabbed a hold of one and he looked down that 400 foot, how am I going to do it? And he tied enough ropes together and he started lowering this man down. And bullets are whizzing all over. And this man knew that God was involved and God was going to try to help him rescue these injured people. And at the end of a couple nights, he had brought 75 men down over that ridge. And I had to think when I thought of that account, my mind actually went to, nobody's seen him doing this. Not until later was he awarded all these medals and all these honors. When I think of Desmond Doss, I think of the sisters, the mothers.
You know, sometimes maybe you feel like you go unnoticed, all the things that you do. But I think if you going through your life, speaking, blessing, loving, cherishing, helping, serving, how crucial is this? You know, when you think of war and you think of soldiers, do you think of yourself? Or is this maybe just a message for the men? It's a wrong thought, I can assure you. It's a wrong thought. We need Jonathan's. We need Gideon's. We need David's and Eleazar's. We need Ruth's. And we need Esther's. And we need Mary's. And we need Martha's. We need people to fight in this war together. We need people to realize the value of this battle, the value of this war, the value that each one of you can participate in and provide for all around you. Am I a soldier of the cross? It's the one thing every war needs, and it's soldiers. Can we relate this to the battle we're facing? Is it hard for us here in America to see this? Is it hard to think that maybe you would become lukewarm and fall away? Is it hard for you to believe that possibly you could be deceived? When you think about powers and principalities, when you think about the warfare that is raging, what do you think is going on in this room right now? When you wake up in the morning, when you kneel, when you open up the Word of God, do you see the warfare that's raging? Do you sense the battle that's raging? What if we could see it? What if we could just take a glimpse of all the demons? All the powers of darkness that are out to kill you. You know, this war is not between God and Satan. That war is long over. This war is over you and it's over me. This battle is for the souls of men. That's what's at stake. I hear people say, how can it be that God is letting the devil win? It isn't so. God has already won, but now it's your choice. If you want to join this battle, it's your choice. If you want to put on the shield, if you want to grab the sword, if you want to lace up your boots, and if you want to fight against the enemy, if you want to be victorious against darkness, the war is between the Spirit of God and the works of the flesh, between good and evil. In Job here it says that the sons of God met God. There's a little meeting going on. And you get this picture that Satan comes walking up. Just an interesting little account. It's like a little meeting, a little brother's meeting going on, and here comes the devil. And God looks over at the devil and says, where'd you come from? And his answer is always, it's always caused me to tremble from going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it. Do we realize this? The message tonight is a call to fight. The title of the message is titled The War. We have a call to fight. You fight or you die.
You know, sometimes people call me a pacifist. You have the same thing probably happened to you. And the hair on my neck starts to tingle when I hear that. We are not pacifists. We're warriors. We're soldiers of the cross. We're a soldier of the King's army. And we know what God is doing. We know what the King is doing. You know, you'll have this globe here before us, a picture of the earth. We know that the devil's walking to and fro in it. We know that the powers around the earth are just immense, full of darkness and wickedness and deceit. But we also know that the King is also looking at this picture, isn't he? We know the captain of the army is looking at it. It always comforts my heart. In the book of Acts, when Stephen was martyred, and it says that Jesus stood. Behold, I see the heavens open, the Son of Man standing on the right hand of God. Now we can take that wherever we want to take it, but I'm going to take it the way I take it, that Jesus Christ is looking down on a soldier, and a soldier is about to meet the end. And the soldier's reaching the end of the battle. Is he going to be victorious? And it gets the attention of God. It gets the attention of Jesus. And he stands up and he looks. He's looking for soldiers. He's looking for people to fight in this war. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth. Show himself strong on the behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward me. What an amazing statement. God is wanting to show himself strong on whoever wants to stand up. Whoever wants to accept this challenge. What power is at our disposal? The eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. In Proverbs. And I sought for a man among them. You know, these scriptures should encourage our hearts. God wouldn't need it, would he? He wouldn't need us. I sought for a man among them that should make up the hedge and stand in the gap before me for the land, that I should not destroy it. But I found none. You know, I pray that when we read that, when we read that passage there, our heart is wanting to scream, pick me, Lord. I'm looking for somebody to stand in the gap. There's sin abounding all around. There's wickedness abounding all around. All these people that I've created, that I've formed, that I've died for, that I love, are perishing. I'm looking for men to stand in the gap. I'm looking to and fro for people to stand up and fight in this battle. You know, people often make a commitment, don't they? But a lot of people don't follow through. They make a commitment. I think God stands up and he looks at it. Oh, but they don't follow through. They fade away. They go back to the weak and beggarly elements. They go back to their surface level life. And they give up the battle that's raging. They give up the war that's being fought. They give up the victory that's sure to ensue anybody that wants to fight it, the victory of heaven, the crown. But the hour cometh and now is when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship Him. He's seeking for it. He's looking for somebody to worship Him. The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand and seek God. When somebody says no to the flesh, when somebody says no to the flesh, which we're hearing a lot about this week, it gets the attention of God. God really liked Job, didn't he? There is none like him on the earth. A perfect man, an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil. We know very well that God can have those thoughts toward us. Does he have that thought toward you? You know, sometimes my mind can go, and I'm not sure when I think some things, maybe it's not quite accurate. But I think of how many people right now on the earth are really serving God. How many people are really doing it? They're really surrendered. They've really denied themselves. They've given up everything for Him. We know the Bible says few. I think of the Israelites. There was over 1 million that left Egypt, and there was 2 out of that group that made it. We know the flood. The whole world, there was 8 saved. This is kind of where my mind starts to go. The Bible gives us some examples of few. And so it makes me wonder, when you look at the whole world and you actually look at the children of God, those that have sat themselves before the holy hand of God and made a commitment that they will do whatever it takes, they will give up whatever it is, that they're going to disciple and teach and train and follow the Spirit of God, how many is it? How many? I mean, I don't even know. Is it 10,000? I don't even know. But what is it? I do know one thing. That it's small enough to know that it wouldn't be hard for each one of you to get God's attention. It wouldn't be very hard for each one of you sisters to have that be said about you. Let that be our goal. What does God think of you? But what if God would say that to the devil? Have you noticed this sister over here? Why don't you try her? Have you visited this little group in Liberty, Kentucky? You know, devil, I don't think you'd gain a foothold there. I've got a bunch of warriors over there. You're not going to mess with them. You can take whatever you want from them. And we know what he did to Job. These people will die for me. These are soldiers of the cross. When you do something special for God, it gets his attention. When you steal a little while away. When you spend a little time or do something special for God, it gets his attention. His beloved. Oh. He takes great joy in it. It's a marvel to me. It's a marvel to me. The creator of the world. The captain of the army. You know, if he was a worldly person in the standards of our world here, you never could talk to him, could you? You couldn't even ever look at him. You might be fortunate if you ever got to take a glimpse at him over a crowd. That isn't how it is with God. God can be personal to every one of us. God cares about every one of us. God wants so badly for you to be victorious, for you to make the right choices. He wants that fellowship. He wants that intimate relationship where he can hold you dear. There is none like Him on all the earth. What a blessed thing. What a blessed thing. What do soldiers look like? You know, I hope our hearts need to be stirred, people. Brothers and sisters, our hearts need to be stirred, but then we must act upon it. It must cause us to do things that we normally wouldn't do. What do soldiers look like? I get a picture of a soldier. Someone recently told me, uniformity never works. I look at the military, and I have to say, that is not a true statement. That is not true. And everybody here knows that's not true. Soldiers are united. It has to be. It has to be that way. Without unity, there's no way for victory. Now, in the military of our lands, it's the same haircut. It's the same outfit. They walk the same. They talk the same. They think the same by the end of that. The goal is for these people to be united. Now I wonder, why is it that that thought right there, when you take it to the church, it gets people so worked up? I mean, it gets people almost angry. Why is that? You know, when the world gets angry about something we're supposed to be doing, that's confirmation for me. You know why it stirs them up? I know why. And I understand why they're upset. They're not in the war. They're not expected to go to Normandy. They're not expected to go to these battles. What's the purpose of this? Why all the fuss? They bought into the lie. But we are different. We're in a war. We're in a battle. When you get into a battle, there's one thing that you're going to want. And that's brothers and sisters with you. If you ever get the thought that you just can't handle it, just remember, you'll never win a battle. You need to be united. You need to have an army around you. An army that's united, and they're united because they spend time with God. When you're sitting there surrounded by the enemy, when the enemy has you surrounded, you're not going to want to be by yourself. You know, just to expose some of my carnality in my older days, I can remember a time where this happened to me. Me and a friend went to a bar one evening just to get something to eat. There was a lot of people in this bar, a lot of people I didn't know. It was our hometown there, so one young person came walking up to me, said, "Hey, Benji, I want to talk to you about something." He was a young man from another town. And we smoked back then. He says, "Why don't you come out and let's smoke a cigarette. I got to talk to you about something." I didn't know what he wanted. Didn't have a clue what he wanted. I hardly knew this young person. And so he walked out of the bar and I walked out behind him. And I remember one thing, and I probably won't ever forget it. But I know that when I walked out of that bar, that door didn't shut behind me. And right then, I knew I was in trouble. Right then, I knew I was in trouble. And so I didn't even look behind me. I just walked out, and next thing you know, I'm surrounded by a whole bunch of men. And I knew I was in trouble. I was by myself. And I knew I had to hold these people off until help came. Until my friends came. And it was a hard, maybe 10 minutes. It was a hard 10 minutes of fighting through that thing. And I can remember around that corner in that parking lot, a few trucks came flying in there with all my friends in the back. And I know that's an awful illustration. We talk about the kingdom of God, but I can assure you that you don't want to be alone when the battle's raging. I can assure you, you're not going to make it. You can be pretty tough. You can be pretty spiritual. You can be pretty strong. But you will be destroyed on your own. You know what? It just shows us. You know, before that, being by myself wasn't a big deal. Earlier that day, whatever I was doing. But when there was a need, when the war happened, I didn't want to be by myself anymore, did I? And I think it's good for us to realize that when the needs are there, we need each other. When the battle's raging, we need each other. You see, if every day of your life there's no needs, then you don't need anything. Does that make sense? Get up in the morning and sure, you have your devotions. Pretty hot maybe. Pretty exciting. But then you go off and do your thing. Go off into your job. Go off into the workforce. Whatever it is. Start taking care of people. Whatever it is, menial task. Not really much need there. Kind of cools off during the day. Your life kind of cools off during the day. It doesn't seem like there's really a battle going on. And you know, maybe you're right. Maybe if you could see the spiritual warfare right then, there would be nothing going on. You're consumed with what you're doing. You're not concerned with the kingdom. You're not involved in the war. The devil says, let him go. He's fine. We'll come back tonight when he picks up his Bible. That's why I think we need to have needs in our life, and we need to make needs in our life. Throughout our day, we're seeking God because we need God. I don't know what it is, what you need to do, but we need to create needs throughout our day. Focus on things that you need to be doing for God. Maybe it's talking to this certain person. I mentioned it the last night to one of the young people. If you made a commitment that tomorrow at noon, you're going to go into Liberty and you're going to have a meeting with the owner of one of the bars there. And you're going to plead with him to repent. You're going to plead with him to let go of his liquor license because he's sending people to hell. What do you think your morning would look like tomorrow? How would that first half of the day go? What if you could see them around you? Do you think there'd be some spiritual powers going against you? You think you'd have got the attention of the devil? I read in a quote just here recently, somebody said, I pray that when I die, the devil rejoices because I'm out of the war. What happened to us? Lord, I'm going to go visit my boss. I've always had fear of my boss. And today I'm going to go there and I'm just going to share the gospel with him. The war is raging. The war is raging. It's up to each one of us. And you know, when you're in that battle, when you're fighting like that, you want to be around mighty men. You want to be around people that are spiritual that can help you. You want to be around sisters that can encourage you. You want to be around people that are in the war. You want to be united with them. You want their support. You want their prayers. I marvel at the rejection of unity in our world. People say, which I look out here tonight in this crowd, and I don't see all blue or all the same haircuts. I don't see. I see unity. When I visit with you, brethren, I see unity. I feel unity. But when we talk about unity and the world wants to throw that away and throw that down, and they start saying things like maybe we should all just wear the same things, and you hear terms like cookie cutter and all that. And I just have to marvel at that, because what really is going on here is I'm professing that I'm in a war and the Lord Jesus is my general. He's my captain. His Spirit's within me. His Spirit's guiding me in everything I do. Are we all attesting to that? Do we all say that's what happens? We all would say that. Well, what about our brother? Is it not the same Spirit that's in him? Why would we be united? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me that we wouldn't be united when we're saying that the same God is dwelling in both of us. When you're at a place where you see the war, where you get desperate, you're going to be at a place of unity with brothers. People are going to want to be around you, and you're going to be one around them. Last time I think I was here preaching, I mentioned about a climbing expedition on Mount Everest. Mount Everest is 29,000 feet. Well, in Asia, I believe it is, there's a mountain called G2. Now, that mountain there is less than 1,000 feet under Everest. It's the second highest point in the world. It's very similar. Now, men and women, more and more women are getting involved in this, but they want to get to the top of these things. They want to get to the top. Everybody's competing for the top, the highest. People die by the droves. 1 out of 4 that goes up Everest doesn't come back. And they flock up there to claim that physical crown. And these expeditions are purely carnal. It's all about promotion of oneself. They call them the seven peaks. It's the seven highest mountain ranges or mountain peaks in the seven continents. A group of men climbed all seven in 4 years. Today it's 7 in 7 months. These people are serious. It normally takes 2 to 3 months to get up and down Everest. These men did all 7 in 7 months. They got it within a few hours. But you never hear about a man or a woman going up Everest. You never hear about one person. I don't even know if they let them. These are expeditions. These are groups of people. And these people train together. These people learn how the other one thinks because their life is in the other person's hands. How they tie a knot could determine whether I live or die. And it's massive. Some of these mountain ranges like Everest and G2, it's $60,000 just to step foot on it. I mean, a lot goes into this. There's a lot at stake. There was a young man named Pete Shoney, and he was heralded as one of the best. One of the best climbers, one of the best mountaineers this world ever seen. He was the first up on this range, and he was the first up on that peak and on this summit, and he did this the fastest. And he decided to take, I believe it was G2 without oxygen, means you don't have any supplemental oxygen, you're going up there without any help. When you get up that high, it can get 30, 40 degrees below zero. About 20 to 30% oxygen. And there were 6 of them that went up. It's 28,250 feet. But these men knew each other so well. There was so much trust there. There was a bond there. These men on this expedition, they didn't know it probably, but they were going to be stranded in the storm. They're going to spend 9 days in a tent on the side of this mountain at 22,000 feet. At 25,000 feet, Pete Schoening's a leader. He has all of them attached to each other with a rope. So you have 6 men going up the side of this steep mountain. This is what they live for, the war. This is their war. This is as hard as it gets. There's a good chance that some are going to perish, some are going to die. But they care for each other. There is no individualistic going on here at all. Pete doesn't say, I'm better than all you climbers, I'm going to go alone. I have a better chance going alone. He knew it's foolishness. He was going to have to go together. And these 6 men all tied together. And sometimes when you get to that kind of altitude, your body starts doing some strange things. And one of these men, his blood was starting to react to this, and they knew that he was going to die very soon. And so they had to make a choice. What are we going to do? And so they decided they went to an edge, and there was a big drop-off. And they knew that they could lower him down to this drop-off. I don't know how many thousand feet it was or how they were going to do it, but if they could get him down this, if they could lower him down, that it would get him in a place of elevation where he could maybe recover. And then when they came down, they could rejoin up with him. And so they put this plan together. And they started lowering. And Pete was the first person, so he took his ice pick and he jammed it in between a boulder and the mountain. He got a good strong hold. And he's the first person, and the rest of them are all roped together. And the last person's the one that's lowering this man down. They had him in a sleeping bag. They wrapped him in a tent, so he's in a big bundle. And they started lowering him down. And as he's a long way down, that last person slips, and over he goes. And we went over. The other one went over. Then the other one. And all Pete can see is that his men are all falling over the edge of the cliff. So he gathered up every ounce of strength he had. He gathered up every bit of energy that he had, and he held on for all that he was worth. And he kept all them men. He kept every one of them. One of the most heroic acts in mountaineering history. For a carnal thing. Do we understand this? Here we are serving the living God. And we'll let it go over a pair of pants. And you know what it's telling us is we don't really see the seriousness of this. We don't really see the war. We don't see the battle. We're not in it. It's all about me. You know, I don't really know. I think of that calf that Brother Philip was mentioning with his front feet are dug in. You know, we got to deal with a lot of animals on our farm, and it seems that happens a lot. What does it take? It isn't going to work. You're not going to win without unity. You're not going to win without denying yourself and denying your will. There is no room for your will in this battle. There's no room for it. These thoughts come to my mind. You know, we hear a lot of teaching on the home. I think it's the best teaching in the world. One of the biggest focuses, which was a new thing for me, obviously, was breaking the will of your child. Breaking the will of your child. Now, to me, that makes sense. Break the 2-year-old's will. But the problem is, a lot of us didn't have a father to do that to us, did they? And so this will has been growing and growing and growing. We do what we want to do. We want to get to heaven, and sure we do, so we do it our way. And we'll step on anybody that we can to get there. So we have a bunch of churches with a bunch of grown men that have not had their wills broken. We've got to realize that until you lay it down until it hurts, you're not going to win the war. You're not going to win the war. We've got to be disciplined. You know, if anybody here has a thought that this Bible school is maybe too disciplined, it's boot camp. It's preparing you for war. And like those men that were about to reach the base of Okinawa, there isn't one of you here that is going to wish it wasn't this disciplined when you're in the heat of it, when you're in the battle. You're going to be thankful for it. If you stay focused on the war. Now, if you go your own way and chase your flesh, yes, you'll resent these kind of things the rest of your life. We live in a country where you really can really have whatever you want. There's no control needed over your own desires. You don't really have to be that self-disciplined. Whatever you want, you get. But you know, a disciplined life, a focus on denying your flesh, is that not what a soldier must do? It's a must. Paul says, "Thou therefore endure hardness
endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No man that warreth entangle himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier.
You know, that's not a command there. That's just a statement. It's just a statement. No man that warreth is going to entangle himself with the affairs of this life. It's just a statement. It doesn't say that if you war, you shouldn't be doing this. It's just a reality. It's a truth. Have control over yourself. Have control over your desires. Be healthy. Be active. It's the opposite of casual. The direct opposite. You know, when you picture the devil, what do you picture? I picture casualness. When you hear in the Bible, when you read about how the devil tempts people, it's always just kind of, well, do you really think you have to do that? And that's just how I picture the devil. He's just kind of this, is that really necessary? I mean, after all, everybody else is doing it. You know, just that's how I sense the devil is. He's very casual. He wants to get you to be casual. A casual soldier becomes a dead soldier. That's where they get the word casualty from, is from casual. If he was in a battle, what kind of soldiers would you want to be around? Cool and casual ones? Ones that have no self-discipline? Ones that don't know how to deny their flesh? You know, it's labeled a lot of things. But you know, if I had a dark, this room is completely black dark, and I put a candle right here, flickering and burning. Everybody's focus would be on that candle. It'd be very easy to see. If you turn on the bathroom lights, it might dim it a little bit. Turn on those back lights, the nursery lights. Eventually, you turn on all these lights, you wouldn't hardly see that candle. The more things that come into your life, the more things you bring into your life, the more desires, the more it clouds out the Spirit of God. You know, that's why people want you to be disciplined. That's why people want you to be governed. Because the flesh just wants to let it all come in. Now, this is, I think, what people term as legalism. But it's reality. It's just reality. You wouldn't see the candle much anymore. Distractions come in and they take the mind of the soldier away from the war. If you can't be content, if you can't control your desires, slowly God leaves. He just does. And once you start accumulating these things, it's hard to go back. It's hard to go back. Once you start amassing these things in your life, once you start getting excited about this, this, or this, it's hard to go back. It's all there to distract you from being a soldier. It wasn't long ago, it may have been a few years now, but when ISIS was terrorizing the world. And you know, ISIS had a little different, I felt, they may have been a little bit like the Japanese. They just had a little fear in people's hearts. They were kind of a brutal group. Now maybe you guys don't know who ISIS is, maybe you don't know their tactics, but they were a brutal group. And you started hearing things like, there's 150 ISIS cells in the U.S. right now. You started hearing things like that. I usually don't believe those things. Whatever. People started looking at Muslims a little different. A little fear was kind of bringing a little rise. But I started to think, what if this is true? What if these headhunters do make it to America? What if all of a sudden this battle we're talking about becomes physical? What if in the middle of this boot camp, we all go out there and out those windows, we start to hear the rumble of trucks, and all of a sudden these trucks start pouring into this parking lot with their big black flags, with their foreign language written on it, men with machine guns and machetes, and they surround this church building. What's it going to look like in here? Are any of you going to be concerned about what you look like? Is there anybody concerned about some small issues you were having? How serious would people get? People would be pretty sober, wouldn't they? But I want to ask this question. Would you be who others would be looking to? Are you a mighty man? I think of a mighty man. And in times like that, we need many of them. Men that are wanting to stand in the gap and protect. Men that are battle scarred, that are ready for the fight. I don't want anything to do with a group of casual, cool people in that moment. I don't. And neither do you. You know you don't. You want men that can stand up for God. You want men that are full of faith and full of power, full of fire, full of zeal, that can take this whole situation and turn it to the glory of God. I believe there are a lot of mighty men here. I do. And you know, if it comes down to it, there's an invasion like that, I'll probably drive down here. I would just encourage you young people, appreciate the authorities you have in your life. Have a desire to be strong. Have a desire in your heart to be noticed by God. Don't settle for carnality. Don't settle for lukewarmness. Don't settle for desires from the flesh. Because not only is it not going to help you in the day of battle, but it's not going to help anybody else either. Don't be the weak link. After all, God is wanting to show Himself strong in you. Wow. That sister is a blessing. Wow. That young man there is a soldier. He is going to make it. She will make it. I want to close with just reading the words of a song. Strive aright when God doth call thee. When He draws thee by His grace, cast off all that would enthrall thee and deter thee from the race. Wrestle till thy zeal is burning and thy love is growing warm. All that earth can give thee spurning, half love will not buy the storm. Perfect truth will love to follow watchfully our Master's ways. Seeks not comfort, poor and hollow, looks not for reward or praise. Soldiers of the cross, take courage, watch in war mid fear and pain, daily conquering sin and sorrow, till our King o'er earth shall reign. God bless each one of you.